The intersection of endurance sport, health, fitness and life. Challenging conventional ideas and empowering people with the science of self-propelled motion. This is the Endurance Experience Podcast, hosted by Tony Rich.
Welcome back to the Endurance Experience Podcast. It's certainly been a pretty surprising few weeks with all of the heightened coronavirus fears. And I've been taking some time to process this and also put out some fires that have been the direct result of the new heightened awareness. The populace is still processing and recalculating new information about the now pandemic and the disease that results from the virus, which is COVID-19. And there still seems to be widespread confusion, as well as some misinformation that's being spread about the virus. And I hope to have a follow-up podcast on this topic to alleviate some of the confusions. So one thing that I keep hearing, for instance, is the coronavirus is no different from the flu, and old people, or quote-unquote old people, are the ones that need to be worried. Healthy young people don't need to be worried, or it's just an overreaction. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the outright doomsday prepper-like panic that's happening. So I want to get the bottom of this and have a podcast on it. In so many ways, this also touches endurance sport with all of the cancellations, the wave of cancellations of marathons. Now the Boston Marathon is postponed and other events. And so the follow-up podcast will seek to get to the bottom of some of these questions and raise awareness. And I'm trying to finalize a subject matter expert to have the conversation with. I've been exchanging some emails this week with a few. And in the true spirit of the endurance experience, I want to have a conversation with an authority, an MD, PhD, subject matter expert in infectious disease, because I want to distill the facts, the truth, the evidence, rather than what I've heard on many podcasts and social media and forums, just talking heads going back and forth, speculating wildly about what they think. And that's not what I want to do. So look for that podcast to follow this one pretty quickly. It should be an interesting conversation. So for now, on this podcast, I want to have a conversation about energy. And I wanted to do this for some time because I think it's a word that's systematically misused. And so today I have a conversation with Dr. Brian Weinstein. Brian has a PhD in physics from a place called Harvard University. You may have heard of it. That's really all I can tell you about Brian, because his career is so top secret that I was asked not even to bring it up. Okay? So, but I can tell you that he is also an endurance enthusiast. And he and his wife, who he talks about in the podcast, Kate, they are immersed, both of them immersed in the endurance enthusiast lifestyle, triathletes, marathon runners. And by the way, both have received coaching from me in various forms over the past couple of years. So why energy? Like I said, it's a word that is systematically misused in everyday life, and especially health, fitness, nutrition, and sport. And I wanted to have a conversation with Brian, who I've named the genius. And he's going to talk to me about the word energy and what it really means in the real world and universe, as explained by a Harvard physicist, someone who understands the word energy probably better than 99% of the people on the planet. And, you know, just sort of distinguish what that word means, what it really means, as opposed to the way that it's commonly used in various pseudoscience circles. So I'll have more to say about this at the end. So we have a great discussion. We talk about the first and second law of thermodynamics, and we try to tie that back to energy balance and the energy balance equation and how that relates to nutrition, weight loss, things like that. We talk about Newton's laws and how those laws are applied to self-propelled motion, swimming, cycling, running, and what people can learn from that. I also get Brian's take on the very crude and often loose ways of using the word energy in the modern health, fitness, and wellness era. And so without further delay, I give you Dr. Brian Weinstein. Dr. Brian Weinstein, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Hello. My pleasure to be here.
All right. Yeah. And thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. And I wanted to, you know, first talk about your academic background, just so our listeners know a little bit about you and how you came into being interested in physics and going through your PhD program.
Sure. Yeah, so how did I become interested in physics? I'd say that happened in high school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I just really liked math and science. And when I learned about physics, that on a single sheet of paper, we could explain, you know, let's say 90% of what we see in the world around us, I was just amazed and I was hooked. So I got, I went to Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. I got a degree in engineering physics with an aerospace engineering like concentration. So that was like my bachelor's. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to Harvard's Applied Physics PhD program. And yeah, I got my PhD in Applied Physics, and I also did some computational physics on the side. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun.
Now, that's very impressive. Physics, I sort of look at physics as being the senior science, highly mathematical, and getting a PhD in general is an amazing feat. Getting a PhD through that Harvard program, that's even more impressive. What was that like?
Yeah, getting a PhD anywhere, I think, is pretty similar. It's long, it's painful, and although the first couple of years might be pretty fun, it becomes less fun as a function of time. Yeah. And it's not because the research isn't interesting. It's because there are other issues you want to contend with. Maybe you want to finish, you want to move on with your life, you want to start doing something else. Mm-hmm. It's just very long. So, for example, I took about 6 years to finish my PhD and master's altogether. And that was pretty standard for me. So if you want to do a PhD, you have to be willing to devote that time. It's long. Mm.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So I wanted to have this podcast for some time. I wanted to dive into the topics of the intersection of physics and sport, exercise, wellness, nutrition, and so on. and someone like yourself might be able to shed some light on some of these topics and sort of bring it down to the level of the layman who might be listening. There's so many areas where I think physics touches sport, or specifically endurance sport.
Yep.
Nutrition, self-propelled motion, all of it. So first, I wanted to talk about energy, right? So the word energy, and you hear people will use the word energy in health, fitness, wellness, very loosely. They'll throw around the word energy, everything from energy healing to all types of ideas about energy that's given off by humans. You hear people say, colloquially say, oh, someone's giving off bad energy or good energy.
Yeah, sure.
Or they're just very loose ways of throwing around this word. And I always thought it would be very interesting to hear a physicist take on some of that when they hear the word energy being used so loosely. I mean, it probably grates like fingernails down a blackboard to you. let's talk about that. So first, let's talk about thermodynamics. So first and second law of thermodynamics, and trying to see if we can sort of get this, break it down for the layman first, and then we can go into how this is relevant to things like sport, fitness, nutrition, and so on.
Yeah, sure. So let's first talk about what energy is. Perhaps the easiest way to explain energy is if you lift something up, it has, it's in a gravitational field, like on Earth, it has more energy. We'd say it has potential energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you release it, that thing will fall, and that potential energy will be converted to kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes into the first law of thermodynamics, which is essentially a restatement of the fact that energy is conserved. So let's say I'm in outer space, there's no air, there's no friction or dissipation. If all the potential energy and like a pebble I dropped from outer space as it fell would be converted to kinetic energy. Okay. So if we sort of blur our eyes and imagine just a big container around that pebble, imagine like a big sort of volume, energy in that box is going to be conserved. But I guess I'd say the first law is something a little more. If you're pumping energy into the box, it basically means that the energy in the box is going to increase.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about conservation of energy.
Right. Yeah. Right. That makes sense. So to restate what you're saying, everything is potentially energy. The desk I'm sitting at.
Yeah.
Could be considered energy. It can be converted into another form of energy.
Right, like E equals MC squared, right? So Einstein, energy, mass times the speed of light squared. So yes, actually matter is a form of energy.
Matter and energy is basically interchangeable, which is a very mind-boggling concept to think that every single thing, everything, the planet, all matter that we interact with on a daily basis is essentially energy.
Yep.
So how does that apply on the second law? The second law.
Yeah. So the second law of thermodynamics is a little more tricky, I'd say. It deals with the directionality, right? For example, why does time appear to move in one direction, right? Like, why if I drop a baseball, doesn't it just spontaneously float upwards a bit, like back towards my hand, right? And that's because all processes generate something called entropy, which just deals with irreversibility. So basically, the second law states that for any, let me try to think of the best way to put it. It basically says entropy will always continue to increase. So like things will get more chaotic in time, essentially. But it also deals with heat. It turns out the same definition of entropy, you can state that if I have two things at two different temperatures, heat will always flow from the more hot thing to the colder thing, right? And that sort of deals with the same idea, just radiance, drive, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so sort of irreversibility. So something is always going to, you know, dissipate eventually. Okay. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think, you know, someone who doesn't have a PhD in physics from Harvard could understand that, right? And so it's just...
Give him my best shot.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable to hear the word energy you just thrown around so, you know, very willy-nilly all of the time. So let's try to apply this to a real-world example that almost everyone out there can relate to, this idea of calories and what we call in the fitness world energy balance, calories, and how energy really is something that we can talk about in the form of energy or thermogenesis, the energy that we take in and the energy that we expend, and how that sort of relates to first and second law of thermodynamics, this idea that inanimate objects and animate objects all correspond to this same law. So let's talk about energy balance, and first let's try to frame calories essentially. So what is a calorie? How do we measure it?
Sure. So it turns out there are two different types of calories. There's a calorie, which is defined, and that's not the one most people use when I say calorie. Mm-hmm. That's the amount of heat energy that is needed to raise the temperature of 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. And most people talk about, when they say calorie, they mean a kilocalorie, which means that the amount of heat or energy, note that heat and energy are the same units, they're interchangeable. Mm-hmm. That's the amount of energy needed to increase the temperature by 1 degree Celsius of 1 kilogram of water.
Right.
Okay. So the idea is that when we eat food, we're basically, if we imagine ourselves as a, one of those volumes I talked about earlier, I'm putting energy into my system in terms of calories, and that is burned by our body, and that, is expended in terms of heat to keep us warm, our basal metabolic rate, all sorts of stuff like that, and it's used or stored in terms of fat or muscle.
A calorie being the amount of energy, the energy in the purest form of the word, energy that it takes, heat energy that it takes to heat 1 liter of water, 1 degree, right?
And so 1 kilogram of water.
Yeah, we can and we can measure that pretty objectively. And so, and I know from my nutrition history that and I don't think they use it much anymore. They used to use something called a calorimeter or a bomb calorimeter to measure the heat energy that it would take to just completely incinerate various types of foods, right? So when they look on the back of a label and they see something is, 150 calories, say. So we would interpret that as the amount of heat energy needed to completely incinerate whatever that is. Is that, yep. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I think it's worth pointing out, though, the conditions at which the stuff is burned. Mm-hmm. So the way a bomb calorimeter works is, yeah, I believe that's what they still use today. They hold your, let's say, cheeseburger in a box with very strong walls so they don't, you know, expand or compress. They then basically light the cheeseburger on fire, generally using some sort of electrical cord. And what will happen is because that box is sealed, mm-hmm. and the walls don't expand or compress, the pressure in that box will dramatically increase and a lot of heat will be generated.
Right.
And they actually measured, they basically put that calorimeter in a big heat bath and measured the change in temperature of that heat bath to determine the amount of calories in the thing. So I guess I just want to point out that the fact that it's kept at a constant volume as you're burning is pretty important, as opposed to like just burning a cheeseburger, like, I don't know, on your table or something.
It's right.
Just, the amount of energy expended and such can be different.
Right. You have to have it done in a controlled way in order to get the accurate reading.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And so there is the thermodynamically based calculation by the physician Wyschnowski that derived the caloric deficit needed in order to lose 1 pound of body fat, basically using the same method. And that's where we get the popularized 3,500 caloric deficit figure. That's where that comes from. And that if you completely incinerate a pound of body fat, all one need do is measure the energy that it took to do that. And that's where that figure comes from. In practice, however, while you do need to be in negative energy balance in order to lose body fat, deriving the exact deficit required by the human body is more complex. And for many reasons, too long for this podcast, the exact caloric deficit might be different than that popularized figure.
Yeah. It is worth pointing out, though, that the human body, you know, when we eat a cheeseburger, it does not incinerate the burger the same way that bomb calorimeter would, right? And a cheeseburger may also have water weight in it, which mm-hmm. Won't go to nutrition for us. It'll just be passed as waste, right?
Exactly, yeah. And,
yeah, so not every calorie gets absorbed, I guess, in your system, right? But it's there's no better metric for determining how much energy is going into your system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about that. The energy balance equation. Mm-hmm. With a nutrition background, I can set the framework for it. So
yeah,
if you imagine everything that is part of your expenditure on one side, and you can imagine everything that you consume on another side. And so the components that make up your energy expender, your first is something called your basal metabolic rate, which is everything that you would completely burn if you were at rest for 24 hours. And that is a pretty large component of your energy expenditure. And then, of course, there's your exercise activity, non-exercise activity.
Yep.
And then there's the amount of energy that it takes to digest the food that you're consuming. So the energy balance equation is one of the reasons that we lose and or gain weight. It's really hard to get at some of these numbers in practice. And some people can sort of try to will these numbers, but it's in principle very challenging to do, which is really why a lot of people fail at the whole calories in, calorie out process.
Right.
Yeah, it is worth pointing out, at least from like a thermodynamic perspective, when it comes to, you know, losing weight, it's all about calories in versus calories out, right? Mm. It's hard to exactly measure how many calories you put in that are actually needed by your body. Mm-hmm. And then it's also hard to figure out how many calories you're losing by everything else. But
yeah.
You know, there's no other way to lose weight, right? Ultimately, every diet comes down to calories in versus calories out. And they might obfuscate the fact, but, you know, that's always true. And it comes back to thermodynamics.
Yeah. And that's the... And that's where it connects.
Oh yeah, I mean that's all it is. It's just energy in versus energy out, and you know, I find that the best diets are the ones where you eat a lot and get full on few calories in, mm-hmm. and you know, increase your activity to increase your calories out. Right. That's really all there is to it. I mean, you can eat bacon all day or meat all day or whatever in your crazy diet, but. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, you got it. And of course, and on top of that, I mean, there are other influences and behaviors and such. For you know, for instance,
right.
The mind is something that contributes heavily to influence you to you know, whether it's increase energy expenditure or energy intake, and so then there's things like. Human stress hormone, cortisol, that can impact you, and so the brain is a very complicated driver of behavior. So that is one of the things that is sort of the mystery box there with this.
Right.
All right. So that's great information. So let's. Talk about, you know, when you go into Newton's laws of motion, for instance,
sure.
And talk about, you know, our disciplines of endurance sport, swimming, cycling, running, and what can the average person draw, conclusions can they draw from Newton's laws of motion as it relates to swimming, cycling, running, biomechanics?
Yeah, sure. So Newton's laws of motion are what got me into physics in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
With these three equations, or I guess three statements, you can describe almost everything you see in the world around you, besides, I guess, like electrical effects and maybe like relativistic effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which you probably shouldn't see that on a daily basis. Okay, so Newton's first law of motion, that basically says that an object in motion tends to stay in motion, or will stay in motion, unless it's acted upon by another force.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Galileo was the person who first came up with this. I don't know if that's true, but it's kind of a startling observation, because, you know, if I throw you a ball, Tony, and, you know, you don't catch it, it comes to rest, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it just so works out that if you're in space and there's no, you know, friction or whatever, if I throw a ball, it'll just keep going until another force acts on it, like gravity.
Mm-hmm.
The second law of, Newton's second law says that the net force on an object equals its mass times its acceleration. So what does that basically mean? It says that if you rearrange that equation, it says that, the force divided by mass applied to something equals acceleration. So what that means is if you're smaller, if you have less mass, you'll be able to accelerate faster.
Mm-hmm.
Right? My wife, she's very tiny, actually, and, she actually takes part in Tony's triathlon class every week. Because she's so tiny, when she's going up hills on her bike, she can just zoom up, right? Because she can accelerate very fast. Whereas someone who's bigger on a bike, like me, I tend to do better on the straightaways, in part because once I get going, I have more basically momentum, right? And forces that are applied to me, such as, like, I don't know, an air gust won't slow me down as much because I won't accelerate as much because I'm more passive. And the third law of motion is probably the most wacky one. And what that states is that for every force, there's an equal and opposite force, basically. So what that means is, for example, Earth's gravitational field is pulling down on you, right? It's pulling us to the center of the Earth. Mm-hmm. In contrast, I am actually pulling on the center of the Earth due to my gravitational force, right? So, and if you add those two forces together, the net force is zero. And that can actually be related back to conservation of energy and other interesting things like that. Mm-hmm. I guess that sort of comes in down, in terms of self-propelled motion. I guess I'd say swimming is the most obvious application for that, right? If you basically push water behind you, there will be a force that will propel you forwards, right? So that comes from Newton's third law. And that's very important in outer space, actually, when you're trying to propel something in that the atmosphere. You can let out gas or mass, which will propel you around because you're, equal opposite force.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's so much there. And yet, it's very interesting. You mentioned Kate is a great example because someone smaller like Kate ascending a hill on a bike will ascend that hill with an easier effort than someone, for instance, large or wielding a heavier bike, right? So you have all of these forces. You have gravitational forces on a bike. You have things like rolling resistance, wind resistance, which is a gigantic factor for cyclists. A significant amount of energy of a cyclist goes towards trying to overcome wind. And so over the years, we've adapted things like aero bars, lighter bikes, things like that, carbon fiber bikes, and try to get through the wind with less effort. So there's a lot of Newton's laws in cycling, and similarly, like you said, in swimming, there's fluid dynamics, very similar to aerodynamics. I think the calculation is that water is something like 800 times more dense than air.
Yeah, I think it's probably more like 1,000. But
yeah.
That's about right.
That's significant, right? So that just goes to show you that when you're in the water, if water's more than 1,000, more than 1,000 times more dense than air, it really shows you that any type of drag that you're creating is just going to get magnified substantially. Mm-hmm. So, fluid dynamics is really, really important in water.
And I guess what I'd say, in addition to Newton's laws of motion, they can be recast as additional conservation laws, right? So at the beginning of this podcast, we talked about conservation of energy. Mm-hmm. Another interesting conservation law is conservation of momentum. So that's opposite other forces. But why I think that's interesting is momentum is roughly mass times velocity. Mm-hmm. So if something's more dense, like like water as opposed to air, and you push the water behind you, which will have a certain mass times velocity, you yourself will then move forwards with a different velocity. So the reason why you can basically push yourself forwards in the water and not air is because it's so much more dense and mm-hmm. momentum is conserved.
Yeah. And, you know, it's another reason why we try to, you know, teach good technique in the water. Because if you have good technique, you have to do less work. I mean, oftentimes, especially triathletes, try to, you know, just sort of power through their swimming without sort of working on technique or over time trying to get technique better. You know, technique right. really takes time to really work and improve. But if you do take the time to work on it, improve it, streamline your body in the water, it can have a tremendous impact just on trying to let the water work for you versus expending a lot of energy trying to overpower water with bad technique.
Right.
And you mentioned on running too, and that's also where there's a lot of physics involved. Because mm-hmm. we've seen a lot of talk about how mass impacts a runner, and there's a lot of that, and it's pretty consistent across any discipline of self-propelled motion that power to weight ratio is a factor, right?
So, yes.
And you know, we see some of the elite marathoners, you see very consistent power to weight ratio among them. That's the reason why they can move so fast for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to overcome gravity. And so running really is just a series of controlled jumps and falls. You're literally jumping and falling from one leg to the other. So overcoming gravitational resistance and such.
Right.
It's pretty amazing how much physics are in just about everything.
Yeah, and especially self-propelled motion, right? Mm-hmm. It's the physics of our bodies and the world around us, which I think is especially interesting. I also want to point out to listeners, we've talked a lot about energy,
mm-hmm.
Which has units of joules or calories.
Mm-hmm.
Power is actually just like energy per unit time. Right, so you can think of like energy flow, for example. Mm-hmm. So I know on my Strava watch, it gives me a when I'm running, like a certain amount of watts I'm putting out. Right, that's how many joules per unit second, I believe.
And people should realize. I did a podcast with Hunter Allen, who is one of the experts in training with a power meter, and I talked about on that podcast in the early days of the Science Museum. I don't know if it's still there. They used to have an exhibit where you would get on a bike and then you would pedal and see how many lights you could light up. And the lesson from that exhibit was your energy is directly transferable into wattage, meaning
yep.
if I put out 40 watts, I could light up on a bike, I could light up a 40 watt light bulb. And the exhibit was to show you that, how that was transferable into actual electricity. So amazing applications of physics in exercise and in wellness and nutrition in everything. So it's just good to get someone who can explain it from the level of physicists and bring it to the layman folks out there who don't have these genius level degrees like yourself.
Oh, well, thanks, Tony. But yeah, I hope this was helpful. Hopefully, I haven't dealt with some of this stuff in some time. So
now
yeah.
You're an endurance enthusiast yourself. So
yep.
talk about your history. So you ran a marathon recently, right?
Yeah, I got in the lottery for Chicago. I ran it in, I think, 4 hours and 17 minutes. I think I could have broken 4 hours, but, you know, things happen during a marathon.
That's an excellent time for the first time. And, yeah, what are some of the other pursuits? You got any more goals in the endurance sport world?
I'm not sure. I mean, I recently ran a 5K in about 24 minutes. I'd like to get a little faster at the 5K and half marathon. I'd say the marathon is a little too long in the sense that you have to train for like 16 to 20 weeks. And if you just get injured on one day, it feels like those 16 to 20 weeks weren't worth it, mm-hmm. right? I just find it really frustrating. I'd say half marathon is sort of more my style. I'd also, my dad recently gave me his old bike, and I'd like to try to get more into riding that and maybe do a triathlon at some point, Tony.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you got all the math ready. All you got to do is, I can just see you now in your basement with your whiteboard, writing out all of the equations, trying to figure it all out, and then in no time you'll be out there racing the Ironman World Championship just on your knowledge of physics alone.
I wish that would make me faster.
All right.
Maybe I can just end on one thought, Tony.
Yeah,
if you
go mind. For it.
I know you talked about at the beginning, you sort of asked, what do I think about people talking so loosely about energy?
Right? Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, people always talk about, things like vibrations, and I can feel a vibration of everything. Well, I think it's neat that energy is actually present in everything, and mm-hmm. it can be transferred from one form to another, right? So if people are looking for some sort of, cosmic thing to worship instead of stones or whatever thing. I mean, and energy is pretty cool. And I guess what I would also say is if you think that's cool, like the first law of thermodynamics that energy is conserved, they come from more, this blew my mind, more fundamental symmetries. Like conservation of energy comes from time reversal symmetry. If something looks forwards, backwards, and forwards in time, conservation of angular momentum comes from translational symmetry. A lot of physics can be broken down to symmetries. I don't know. I think that's cool.
Yeah, and I think you're right that people long for some sort of spiritual or cosmic type of understanding. But when you hear of things like an aura, people will say, oh, you can read somebody's aura. Okay, well, if you think that's true, we can test that.
Right.
We can test that. All you got to do is, we'll set up a barrier, and then have people randomly walk behind that barrier unseen, and then have the people who can claim to see an aura tell us where that person is behind the barrier, or if a person is behind the barrier.
Right.
That's an easy, it could be done double blind or blind. Can be formulate an experiment to see whether or not anyone can do that. Now, I've seen this experiment done before, and needless to say, the aura identifier fails miserably all the time. It's interesting. So when I hear people sort of loosely talking about auras or rocks that can heal and things like that, I always wonder, I wish I had a physicist right here just to hear this and just to get the explanation. I think most of the time science people just sort of look the other way with some of this stuff, but it's coming in more and more in the wellness industry because you're starting to see a lot of people use the word holistic, people use the word energy healing.
Yeah.
People making claims that they can heal bodies with quote unquote energy. But this is a good podcast and a good conversation. I think always, you know, having a science and evidence-based approach when you're talking about exercise, nutrition, sports, you know, and training solutions, recovery, all of that. It's very important.
Yep.
Well, great. Well, thanks for your time. Do you have a social media presence, a public social media presence, or no? Do you stay off?
No, not really. I try to stay off. I do have a page on GitHub, actually, which probably shows you the type of scientist I am.
give it to him.
Okay, let's see. It's btweinstein.github.io. Hold on, let me see. btweinstein.github.io. That I made that website when I was leaving grad school. Detail some of my interests. Nothing about sports, though. Maybe I should add that. I like that website. That one's pretty cool.
Well, now you're going to get the endurance experience bump. You're going to get the bump.
That's right.
Tons of volume now. All right. Well, thanks for your time, Dr. Weinstein.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tony.
All right.
Thanks again to Dr. Weinstein. And as usual, just to finish up the podcast, a couple of final thoughts. As you learn from the episode, according to the laws of thermodynamics, energy is never created or destroyed. It just gets transformed from one form to another. And humans are no exception to these rules and laws. We convert energy from food and we expend energy in various different ways. Now, precisely estimating the underlying variables are impractical because, as Dr. Weinstein explained, biological systems are not the same as simple mechanisms like a bomb calorimeter. And in the absence of a laboratory, it's always going to be difficult to precisely estimate the some of the key underlying variables of energy balance. But a basic understanding of energy balance and knowing the magnitude of the underlying levers, it does provide the average person everything that they need to know to make smart choices about their behaviors and consumption to inform how to get a desired effect or outcome with respect to nutrition and fitness. Sometimes you'll hear someone say, over the years, I've tried everything under the sun with fitness and nutrition, and I haven't been able to make any headway at all. None of it worked. And so what I would say to that person is, based upon this discussion that we had here, what you need to understand is that it is actually impossible to be in negative energy balance and not lose body fat or change body composition. Okay, there's not many things that we can say that are impossible, but that would be literally impossible in that if you were in negative energy balance and saw no changes, that would be something that breaks the laws of physics. It would break the thermodynamics rule, and that's not possible. So oftentimes when people say that, it is just a fact that they are essentially missing something in their understanding of energy balance or the energy balance equation, or they may be thinking that they're in negative energy balance and they're not. But it would be impossible to be in negative energy balance and not lose body fat. Again, it's not about trying to, with spurious precision, trying to gain the calories in, calories out, but it's just understanding at a broad level the levers that you need to pull in order to make changes insofar as you need to or want to make body composition changes. And that means just understanding when your expenditure and consumption relationship is in balance, how to achieve the negative energy balance you need in order to influence changes. That's all. Now, as far as the frequent misuse of the word energy, I have to read this story from a page that I've followed for years on Facebook. I can't say the name because there's a swear in it. It just says, I effing hate pseudoscience. I'll put the link to this story in the show notes. But this story sums it all up. I cannot improve on the story, so I'm just going to read it. It says the following. My grandmother, a woman wise beyond her years, was one of the most generous people I have ever known. Even though she lived in poverty by most standards, she always had a little bit of money or a cool toy to give to her grandchildren when we'd visit. As we grew up, some of us came to rely on her for help from time to time. She couldn't afford a car and didn't have cable TV, yet if you were in a pinch, you could always count on her to pull out a wad of money from a stash box, cubbyhole, or some other carefully considered hiding area. It was always different, and make everything okay again. Of course, we tried not to take advantage of this, and invariably when someone attempted to pay her back, she would refuse, saying she was sure we could use the money more than she. She was a completely selfless woman who derived more joy from seeing her children and grandchildren flourish than she would ever get from spending money on herself. This is why it was so disheartening when, during the last few years of her life, she had to resort to borrowing money. My grandma, like most older people, had health problems, though they were comparatively minor. During her efforts to exercise and stay social, she joined an activity center for elderly folks. There she met a young woman who introduced her to the idea of aural and soul energy. My grandmother became convinced that her health problems were due to bad energy and eventually started paying to have her energy cleansed, a service which she was charged $100 per session. Eventually, she found herself in a situation where she had to burden her family to cover the expenses of these so-called treatments. Most of us simply saw this as an opportunity to pay her back money that we certainly owed to her, but I know it caused great distress for her to have to ask. She was, however, afraid that if she stopped having her energy cleansed, she would die. And she wanted to have as much time to spend with her family as she could. When she finally passed, we discovered that she had sold her grave plot, something she was adamant about paying for herself in order to continue these treatments. My grandma had dedicated the last years of her life to maintaining an energy that never existed. We see a lot of talk about energy in pseudoscience. We are told chi is life energy. Ghosts are spiritual energy. Physics can sense negative energy. And crystals can focus healing energy. The problem with these statements is that they hold no meaning scientifically and reveal a lack of scientific understanding by those who speak them. Ironically, this sort of language is often used successfully by proponents of pseudoscience to gain a sense of legitimacy. Energy is a technical term that means only one thing: the ability to do work, a measurable work potential. Energy can be used, it can be stored, but it cannot be imprinted onto a house or felt from negative thoughts. If you ever hear the word energy being used, replace it with the phrase ability to do work and see if it still makes sense. If not, then it's probably a meaningless statement.
Follow Event Horizon Endurance Sport on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for training programs and services to become a member of our Endurance Institute, or for a complete archive of podcasts, log on to our website, eventhorizon.tv.